I'm going to begin with a bit of, I suppose, as expected, a bit of a non-event with Michael Gove, with his new, much trailed definition of extremism. Not going to quote directly. I have read the government paper on this, so I'm sort of paraphrasing, but basically, there's three headings being presented, and that is extremism is about undermining British values, including liberal parliamentary democracy, and that is through by promoting, quote unquote, violence, hatred, or intolerance. A second approach is seeking to undermine or replace parliamentary liberal democracy. And the third one, and that is creating an environment that might lead to one of the above definitions. So three is about creating an environment which allows people to undermine parliamentary democracy by promoting violence, hatred, or intolerance. And the other one is seeking to replace liberal parliamentary democracy. So far, three organizations have been mentioned. Remember, and this is not unimportant, we're not talking about a government ban. This isn't about making organizations illegal. What it's about is that these terrible extremists aren't going to be engaged with by the government. And that means by government ministers, government advisors, but also civil servants. So the three organizations that the government isn't going to engage with includes, I can't remember its full title, I haven't bothered even looking it up. But basically, the National Socialist something of Nazi Party, in other words. So the government isn't going to engage with outright Nazis. Well, sort of doesn't surprise me. Not going to give them grants either. Well, as I say, I'm absolutely gobsmacked about that one. One that I have heard of, and that's a breakaway from the British National Party, that's called Patriotic Alternative. These are people that have been responsible for picketing migrant hotels, for example, and posting videos of them invading such accommodation. So the government isn't going to engage with them. Well, how about that? But more seriously, although I don't know the fifth organization, I do know of the third and fourth organization. I'll deal with the biggest first, and that's the Muslim Council of Britain. This is a big umbrella organization. I couldn't tell you every organization that's under its banner, but I would guess that it would include a good percentage of British mosques. They'll be affiliated through this channel or the other. And for example, if you take the pandemic, the Muslim Council of Britain actually did supply useful service to the government in the form of advising the Muslim community about the safety of vaccines. If you remember, I'm only vaguely remember it myself, there were stories going around that the vaccines were either made with or using pigs, for example, which in the Muslim religion, I suspect just like the Jewish religion, is an unclean animal, and it was leading to a very low take up amongst Muslims. And the Muslim Council of Britain played the useful role, as I understand it, through its channels, letting out in assurances that this wasn't the case, that the vaccine was safe, and it wasn't haram. But we don't know whether the government will engage or not engage with the Muslim Council of Britain, because these are just examples of possible organizations that will be named. And of course, it won't be Michael Gove directly that chooses which organizations are not to be engaged with. It will be civil servants and special advisors will be appointed from the civil service to actually draw up the list. So I would very much expect that the British Nazis will be on there because, like, do we really sort of expect British ministers and British civil servants to engage with these people? No, I'd never expected that they would. The Patriotic Alternative, I suspect they were there. But the Muslim Council of Britain, will they be there? I don't know, but it does strike me that this gives something of the game away of what Gove is playing at. And it's clearly designed to provoke or feed into an anti-Muslim, the anti-Muslim agenda. And so the fourth organization, as I say, I've forgotten what the fifth is. The fourth organization is the Muslim Association of Britain, the MAB. And this organization, although it strenuously denies it, is affiliated, is closely related, is a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood internationally. And if you look at the definitions that we began with, I have to say that I find it very hard to see how the Muslim Council of Britain feeds into that definition. But I also find it very hard to see how the Muslim Association of Britain feeds into that definition. The Muslim Association of Britain, as I said, is the British branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is illegal in Egypt, but has no history, certainly not in any recent times, of engaging in violent armed struggle or anything like that. Now, it's true that if we look at the Muslim Brotherhood internationally, one of the developments of it was the Muslim Brotherhood in Palestine, which is also known as Hamas, which is illegal in Britain, is, as the BBC endlessly tells us, a terrorist organization, or I would put it, part of the Palestinian resistance, because from my angle, people have the right to resist colonial takeover. They have the right to resist conquest, as happened in 67, for example, but going back to the very origins of Israel itself, which of course began with a civil war in Mandate Palestine between Arabs and Jews, but also then involved a war between Israel and its Arab neighbors, which was continued in 67 and is being continued now. In other words, Israel is an ongoing colonial project, and I would classify Hamas as part of the resistance alongside, used to be anyway, Fatah, the PLO, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and a whole list of other smaller organizations. But there's no way, if you look at the Muslim Association of Britain, is it advocating armed struggle in Britain? If you look at its very anodyne website, what you'll see is sort of corporate talk about education, lots of round table dialogues that it is engaged with in terms of Christians and Jews. Definitely wants to be seen doing that. But also, if you look at MAB, where it actually has a problem with the British government, and for that matter, with the main opposition party, is clearly the question of Palestine, Israel, Gaza, and all the rest of it. And then when you look at their website, what you find, of course, is MAB is one of the sponsors of the huge demonstrations that we've seen in London since October the 7th. I've written about the Muslim Brotherhood in general. I've also written about the MAB specifically. And from my understanding of the MAB, is that this is an organization mainly organizing Muslims from the Middle East. That distinguishes it from the Muslim Council of Britain, of which the MAB is an affiliate. But of course, also what distinguishes MAB is not only its cooperation with the left in organizing these huge demonstrations, i.e., cooperating with CND, I would include Palestine Solidarity as part of the left, but I'd certainly include Stop the War Coalition, for example, as part of the left. What distinguishes, of course, MAB is it was not only prepared to march against the Iraq War, as it's now marching against the war against the population of Hamas. It was prepared under the leadership of Anas Altukriti to actually join the left in what I considered and still consider an abomination for the left, i.e., a Popular Front party headed by John Rees, headed by George Galloway, i.e., Respect. And what happened with MAB is, of course, well, Respect didn't do very well. SWP ended up walking out, complaining that it was being persecuted. Either way, what happened is that MAB basically seems to have parted ways with Anas Altukriti and his co-thinkers and gone into hibernation. And I don't know the mechanism by which he became the president again. He isn't president at the moment. As I understand it, there's another Altukriti. I would guess this is part of the same family. Either way, he staged a comeback. And in my view, what you had is a sort of three-way division in MAB between what I would call the innovators, headed by Altukriti, that was prepared to engage with the left. Remember, for these people, the left would be infidels, atheists, people they were bitterly opposed to. This is their origins. In I think it's 28, they were founded in Egypt, and the MB was not only against British colonialism, which dominated Egypt, it was also against the secular left, specifically communism. Communism was a great evil as far as the Muslim Brotherhood was concerned. So for Altukriti not only to march with the left, but to join the left in a joint party is why I would call his wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, his wing of the Muslim Association of Britain, the innovator wing. And he seems to have been overthrown by what I would call a pragmatist wing in alliance with speculation, I admit, in alliance with what I would call a traditionalist wing. So an anti-communist wing, which undoubtedly exists in Britain, let alone internationally, but also a pragmatist wing that was looking precisely as a small organization that organizes mainly migrants. It wanted to engage with the British government. It wanted to serve its community in terms of sorting out immigration problems, housing problems. It wanted to engage in terms of the bureaucracy, in terms of getting grants for charities, for example. But of course, what happened, much to the dismay of not only the traditionalists, but the pragmatists, is precisely the government turned round and branded the MAB as an extremist organization. And I'm not talking about Gove this time round. I'm talking about Cameron. And that basically scuppered MAB, and it's recently revived under, yes, Anas Altacriti, and now another Altacriti. You could argue, and it would be legitimate to argue, that, of course, in terms of its long-term aims, the Muslim Brotherhood is aiming for a theocracy. There's no doubt about it. But that would be true of a lot of religious or religious-orientated organizations. When did, for example, the Catholic Church reconcile itself to democracy or liberal democracy? What about the Zionists? What about the religious Zionists? But the point that the Muslim Brotherhood, and certainly its branch in Britain, would stress is that this relies on winning over the majority. Now, it might be winning over the majority in the way that we saw the establishment of a theocracy in Iran through a referendum, a one and only referendum. But it's very hard to imagine at the moment such a referendum winning in Britain. So, in practical terms, of course, MAB doesn't aim to establish a theocracy. They might dream of it, but it's not a practical proposition. Now, what marks out MAB and a lot of Muslim organizations is precisely their opposition to the war in Gaza, to Israeli expansionism, to Israeli occupation, and the Zionist project of an exclusive Jewish state, using this notorious term that's been branded as anti-Semitic. But in the words of the Zionists, what they're aiming for is a Jewish state from the river to the sea. And sometimes that river isn't the Jordan, sometimes it's the River Nile, and sometimes it's the River Euphrates. Either way, Zionism has a project for an exclusive Jewish state, and that's in the constitution. That's in the constitution of Israel as presently constituted. So, are, for example, Zionists extremists? I sort of shrug my shoulders. I am certainly an extremist. I don't hesitate in saying I'm an extremist. I'm an extreme Republican. I'm an extreme Democrat. I'm such a Democrat, I actually want to move towards a situation of where democracy itself withers away, let alone our version of so-called liberal democracy headed by a hereditary monarch. How is that reconcilable with a democracy? How is a House of Lords reconcilable with democracy? How is, lawyer-made laws reconcilable with democracy? Well, not in my book. So, of course, I preach intolerance. Yes, I do, of exploitation, of oppression. I readily admit it. I want a situation of where the bourgeoisie as a class is expropriated. That's discrimination against a section of the population, perhaps. No, there's no perhaps about it. It's definitely discrimination against part of the population. Yes, we aspire to make this change peacefully, to quote the Chartists, our forebears in the Chartists. We seek to do this peacefully if we can, forcibly if we must, because if you turn the guns of the army against us, if you get American intervention to push back and carry out an operation that we saw, for example, in Chile in 1973, with confining the left to football stadiums before torturing and killing people. We are not going to stand for that. We will split the army. We will use guns if necessary, to protect ourselves and to protect our socialist project, which, of course, we don't imagine for one second, can simply proceed in Britain alone. At the very least, we need countries like France and Germany and Italy and Spain, coming into this project. And of course, we also aim, to carry out the same program in the most important countries in the world, such as the United States, India, and China. Without such countries, our project is not realizable. But yes, that's our project. And yes, we are willing, to raise the question, of the use of force, to protect, our democracy. So yes, of course, we're aiming to win the majority of people. We can't carry out our program if we don't win the majority of people. But yeah, sure, we are extremists. But of course, what we have is this number three definition, which precisely the government is using or will use to, bar charities, Muslim charities, and all the rest of it, that you create an environment of where people question our present liberal democracy. And I presume that also includes an environment where people go out on marches and challenge Britain's liberal democratic foreign policy, its alliance with Israel, for example. Okay, so in terms of this, remember, it's not legislation, this is not a law, this is something that the government is putting forward to civil servants. It becomes a sort of standing order for government ministers. But on the other hand, we take this extremism definition seriously because there is the danger of adding to the list of banned organizations. We have seen Islamic organizations banned. We have seen fascist organizations banned by the government. What distinguishes us in the CPGB, unfortunately, from many comrades on the left, is that when these organizations are banned, we protest. We are not in favor of fascist or Islamic organizations, but we're in favor of them being legal. We're in favor of debating with these people, fighting these people in terms of the battle of ideas. So, for example, when the fascist organization National Action was banned, and it was banned, remember, not because of what its members had done, but because of the ideas of this organization. So, for example, National Action, when it looked at the guy that assassinated, killed Cox, the MP Cox, it didn't do it, but it said along the lines of, and again, I'm paraphrasing on this one, well, one down, 650 or 65 to go, or whatever the number of. No, whatever the number of MPs it is. We said this organization shouldn't be banned. And so the precise danger is that with this definition and with the changing definition of what constitutes anti-Semitism, there is precisely the danger of the Muslim Association of Britain being banned. There is the danger of the Muslim Council, this big umbrella organization, being banned. And there's a danger of self-confessed extremists being banned, such as the CPGB, but not only the CPGB. A few years ago, I was lucky, I'm saying that with a sarky voice, with heavy inverted commas, to read an academic study of, I think it was three guys at Goldsmiths University that have been commissioned by the government into left-wing extremism. We were honored to be named. But it was such a tawdry piece of work. I have to say that as an individual, I was very upset not to be actually, none of my articles were quoted. This is me, who's the sort of weekly worker writer, standard writer on the militia question, the need to establish a workers' militia, the need to defend, the Second Amendment, in the United States. I wasn't named, with some other writer. Was named, but also who else was named? SWP and God bless them, Counterfire. These were extremist organizations, precisely, and this is what the authors said, who ought to be watched in terms of their tendency towards terrorism. I'm being serious. Because, of course, what we get is a drift, and precisely what we have with Michael Gove. Is a definition of terrorism, which is creating a conducive environment for terrorism. And of course, I'm sure armed resistance against an undemocratic army coup would be designed as an atmosphere that's conducive to the overthrow of the present day liberal democracy in Britain. Well, yeah, that's right. My point is that it's not only terror, no, extremism, which is being redefined, and terrorism, which is being redefined. Just look at what is going on with anti-Semitism. If we look at that, it's no longer about hating Jews as Jews. It becomes precisely using slogans such as, I don't know, Hamas is part of the resistance, victory to the resistance. It becomes using the slogan. From the river to the sea, which is used by Zionists. That becomes an example of anti-Semitism. And we've even had the example promoted by the Daily Telegraph, which is no surprise, that if you describe Israel as an apartheid state, that becomes an example of anti-Semitism. And yes, we have the Holocaust Memorial, blah, blah, definition. And its examples of where to criticize Israel as a racist endeavor becomes an example of anti-Semitism. So there is this drift going on that we ought to be aware of. And what we need to do on the left is not to cry out we're moderates, isn't to cry out that we aren't extremists or that we aren't advocating the possibility of armed resistance, for example. We actually need to stand squarely for freedom of speech, for freedom of assembly, unrestricted freedom of speech. That was in the program of the RSDLP, the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party, at its founding Congress. Too many comrades on the left have abandoned. That basic Marxist principle for freedom of speech, but for all the people I don't like. That's not the way to fight for freedom of speech. We need to understand that primarily restrictions on freedom of speech will affect the left, will affect the workers' movement. That's why we fight for the freedom of speech. For patriotic alternative and for foul organizations. Yes, foul organizations like National Action have no sympathy for anything they say, but we recognize that if they get banned, there's a great danger of the left being banned. And of course, we've seen what has happened in the Labour Party. And I'll come to that. In a minute or so. But I wanted to first of all deal with this racism scandal in the Tory party with the donations of Frank Hester, the tech billionaire, I would guess, I don't know, but he certainly got millions to spare, hasn't he? So a 10 million donation to the Tory party. And we're told now. That subsequent to that 10 million donation, he's also donated a further 5 million. But of course, what he's famous for is not making the biggest donation in history, in British history, to a political party. What he's famous for is his remarks from 5 years ago, if I'm correct, of where I think in a racist joke, of where he said something along the lines of, doesn't Diane Abbott make you sick? Doesn't it make you want to hate all black women and she should be shot? I take that as a, how should I put it, a piece of hyperbole, as opposed to an instruction to go out and assassinate Diane Abbott. Either way, it's landed government ministers, of course, in hot water. And what we saw is basically government spokespersons scrabbling around initially once the Guardian had run this particular story, either denying that these remarks had anything to do with race or gender. I mean, black women, you hate all black women, nothing to do with race, nothing to do with gender. Or because he said sorry, we should move on and forget it. And isn't it interesting, you know, when it comes to Prime Minister's question time, showing how the Tory party believes in forgiveness and moving on, Keir Starmer gets up and says, what's this all about, this guy who's donated 10 million quid to you? Do you denounce it as racism? And eventually the government gets its act together and goes, yes, but it was a long time ago. But he said, sorry, but we don't want to give the money back because we're promoting this multi-cultured, marvelous government headed by Rishi Sunak. Look at our Home Secretary, you know, look at all the ministers that we've got from an ethnic background. So also, of course, what Rishi Sunak did is point the finger at Keir Starmer, because of course Keir Starmer was getting up and defending, yes, of course he couldn't do anything else, could he? Diane Abbott. But of course, Diane Abbott has, I don't know how long she's been suspended now, getting on a year, isn't it? For saying, yes, stupid thing. I've got it written down. It's something on the lines of Irish, Jewish, and traveller people do not face racism all their lives. Well, that's a stupid thing to say. It just depends, doesn't it? I know, I mean, from my angle, I'm not Jewish. I'm sure there's been a revival of anti-Semitism in Britain since October the 7th. I would be amazed if that hadn't happened. After all, Israel claims to act on behalf of all Jewish people. Some people will believe what it says. Either way, the point would be that she apologized. I think within 24 hours, people pointed out to her that it was stupid. She said it was stupid, and she's been saying it's stupid, as I say, for something like a year. She still remains suspended. And so, of course, what Rishi Sunak said is, look at you. You not only sat alongside Jeremy Corbyn, you sat alongside Jeremy Corbyn while anti-Semitism was rife in the Labour Party. Look at Rochdale, it's still rife in the Labour Party. And what is Keir Starmer's answer? I'm sort of tough on anti-Semitism. It's quite hard, isn't it? When he did sit in the shadow cabinet with Jeremy Corbyn. Okay, Jeremy Corbyn is suspended from the Parliamentary Labour Party. But clearly, Rishi Sunak doesn't believe in, once you apologise, leaving that one behind. It's too good a weapon for Rishi Sunak to use against Keir Starmer and the Labour Party, and it's too good a weapon for Keir Starmer and the Labour leadership to use against the left. And in a certain sense, as we saw in Rochdale, they get caught on their own petard. Because, of course, what you get is anybody, I would argue, with a human bone in their body that looks at what Israel is doing and doesn't ask the question. I asked the same damn question as this Canada. I didn't talk about, I have to say, a Jewish influence in the media. No, I didn't do that. But I did ask, did Netanyahu turn a blind eye before this attack? Because it was so well organized. They've been preparing for it, from my understanding, for a year. It included paragliders, it included people who were going to scale walls. They've been doing dummy runs for this. They had reports, apparently, from female border guards saying something's going on. Netanyahu was warned by the CIA. We're dealing in terms of Israel-Palestine with the most surely spied upon population on planet Earth. Didn't he know? They've got microphones, they've got agents, they've got agents riddled everywhere. So, yes, I asked the question, was this a deliberate attempt to stage a provocation with which they could respond to? Not to ask that question is dumb, quite frankly, given that Israel is committed to an exclusive Jewish state from the river to the sea. It would be dumb not to ask that question. And of course, the Labour candidate did ask that question. And people in the room basically listened to it because it isn't crazy and it's certainly not anti-Semitic to ask that question. It's dumb, as I said, not to ask that question. But anyway, as I said, what we find is the Labour Party, I think, caught on a petard of its own making. And I don't know, but I'd sort of not be surprised in the run-up and in the course of the general election campaign that Tory HQ, in cooperation with, I don't know, friends in the intelligence service, don't come out with some juicy quotes from a younger Keir Starmer. There are pictures of Keir Starmer, yes, on a Palestine solidarity campaign platform. What did he say? Did he condemn Israeli colonialism? I don't know, but they will know. I've got pictures, you've got pictures, we've all got pictures of Keir Starmer when he was one of the editors of the Pabloite journal, Socialist Alternatives. What was he saying then about Israel, Palestine? What was he then saying about political honesty? I don't know. I don't know whether they will be using this stuff, but I do recall Ed Redd. Red Ed. What was Red about Red Ed? Well, I'd suggest his father. Not much Red about Red Ed, was there? Anyway, we would expect that stuff. We would expect accusations of anti-Semitism to be thrown at Labour candidates, but also, I'd suggest, at the Labour leader. Either way, what we now have in the Labour Party is a division, at least of an important nature between those that say we should forgive Diane Abbott. After all, she said sorry. It was a year ago. She's a wonderful person. I don't agree with her, but sort of idea. People like Harriet Harman have come out with that line. On the other hand, we also hear, straws in the wind. Jeremy Corbyn preparing to stand in the next general election as an independent in Islington North. There's a story going the rounds today about him approaching printers for an election leaflet. How much would that cost, for example? So it wouldn't surprise me that Corbyn isn't let back in. After all, think of the outrage that there will be in the press if Corbyn is, given the Labour whip again. But also, I'd argue the same will apply to Diane Abbott. If she's given the whip, what happens then? I don't know. But precisely having, run with this anti-Semitism campaign, is there any way back for the Labour leadership? Anyway, I did say I would return to this question. And what happened yesterday is that there was a demonstration, I don't know how big, I didn't go on it, called by Stand Up to Racism and the TUC. And this is on the occasion of UN International Anti-Racism Day. And so the SWP, with its Stand Up to Racism hat, got together with the TUC and had a demonstration. And in the course of the demonstration, what they did, they stopped outside the Home Office and they had Jeremy Corbyn there, and they also had John McDonnell. And John McDonnell made a fiery speech in defense of his comrade, Diane Abbott, and called for solidarity with Diane Abbott, called for the reinstatement of Diane Abbott. I absolutely agree with that. We should be in solidarity with Diane Abbott, even though these remarks were made 5 years ago, and poor Mr. Frank Hester had said sorry. Of course we should be in solidarity with Diane Abbott. Of course we should be demanding that Diane Abbott is restored to full membership of the Labour Party, i.e. the parliamentary Labour Party, and is allowed to stand in the next general election if her Labour Party wants to stand her locally. And everything I know about Hackney and the Labour Party in Hackney tells me, yes, the vast majority of Labour Party members in her constituency want her to be their MP, want her to be their candidate. The difference I have with John McDonnell isn't that. The difference I have is that why suddenly come out in solidarity with Diane Abbott? Yes, he came out. Yes, John McDonnell came out in solidarity with Jeremy Corbyn and has been calling for Jeremy Corbyn to be reinstated. But what about Mark Wadsworth? What about Stan Keeble? What about Tony Greenstein? What about Jackie Walker and hundreds and thousands of others who I know were wrongly accused of anti-Semitism, or were first of all accused of anti-Semitism and then accused of bringing the Labour Party into a disrepute? Why hasn't John McDonnell come out in solidarity with them? Are they some sort of lesser human beings because they aren't MPs? I don't know, but it does strike me that we have a two-tier system of solidarity. Or is it because the shadow cabinet looked the other way when these left-wingers were being expelled, were being named and shamed, you know, in the attempt to appease the right that was never going to be appeased and was always demanding more, to the point where we had Jenny Formby, the General Secretary appointed under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, boasting about how it's speeding up investigations and expulsions for anti-Semitism. So, yeah, I am critical, not only of Jeremy Corbyn, but also of John McDonnell. We shouldn't be selective in who we are in solidarity with, because this is a big lie. This is a witch hunt of proportions, I think. Actually, put Senator Joe McCarthy to shame. After all, in the 1950s, there was a Soviet Union. There was a Communist Party of the United States. The Communist Parties were organized internationally. But this anti-Semitism campaign was based on nothing. It was based on a lie, a big lie of Goebbels proportions. So we should name it. We should shame that. That's what we should be doing. Okay. So just a few points now. So it's coming up to quarter two. I think it's worthwhile just mentioning, of course, the deep, deep trouble that the Sunak government is in. My own take on it is that it's Keir Starmer's general election to lose. I'm not going to say that it's a certainty. You know, we don't know what's going to happen in a week's time. It's impossible to predict. But as things look now, it looks like we're on the way to a big Labour majority. Don't expect anything in the way of, you know, democratic gains. If we aren't fighting for it, they ain't going to give it. Don't expect anything big in the way of economic gains, because if we ain't fighting for it, they're not going to give it. But what, of course, this is produced is rumor after rumor, plot after plot in the Tory party to replace Rishi Sunak, not after the general election when he does the inevitable. That's the thing people do nowadays, isn't it? Fall on their own sword. What we have is all sorts of rumors about replacing him before the general election. Of course, Boris Johnson's tragedy is that he resigned as an MP. So he isn't in the immediate running. But we have others, again, who aren't MPs. You know, the very fact that Nigel Farage has been mentioned is quite amazing. But of course, also what we have at the moment is the story about Penny Mordaunt, being the replacement before the general election. I think it's hopeless. You know, it might give the Tories a sort of bounce, but I'm extremely skeptical that it would make any more difference than Jeremy Hunt's flop of a budget made in terms of the ratings for the Tory party. Either way, just a few points. Having gone from a situation of where we had Diane Abbott and Hester and all of that dominating the headlines, remember before that, what was dominating the headlines? Was this story about someone called Kate Middleton, who now is called, I think, something Princess of something or other, and she's married to someone called Prince or something like that. What she did apparently is because she's been out of the public eye for about a couple of hours, is what she did is took a picture or got someone, maybe her husband, to take a picture of her with her kids. And I don't know whether one of them was sulking or one of them had two fingers up, or I don't know. Anyway, she photoshopped the picture to make it perfect. And basically, the photo agencies of the press said, no, don't use it. We're banning it. And various agencies haven't run with it. And it became a big scandal. What's she covering up? I haven't read any of the rumors. I have to. Is a marriage on the rocks? Is she really a lizard? Is she producing lizards, you know, between the hand and the cuff, you know, were scales showing? I don't know. Whatever the rumors were, I don't really care. But the point about it is that what we're being sold in all of this is the images we see in terms of photographs, the images we see in terms of film and videos, the stories that are run in the press are legitimate. They aren't. They're all illegitimate. We should have a skeptical eye when we hear stories run in the press, especially in the middle of a war. Don't believe what you first hear. Begin with skepticism. And that is true about October the 7th, right? Don't believe what the IDF is saying. Doesn't mean it's all lies. Begin with skepticism. Remember the beheaded babies and how Biden had to retract. Well, most people wouldn't remember that Biden had to retract because the beheaded babies has become a truth. The rapes, for example, I'm sure. I don't know whether there were rapes or not, but it wouldn't surprise me if there were rapes, but I don't take it as gospel. In the same way, I don't take, you know, that these demonstrations in London every few weeks are full of hate mongers. Go on a demonstration, see the hate mongers. You'll find it hard to find hate mongers. Oh, unless you're talking about people carrying placards, Palestine shall be free from the river to the sea, which isn't, of course, code for wiping out Jews. It's code for peaceful coexistence in one secular state from the vast majority of people. But yes, I also, in terms of this particular story, I thought it could be worthwhile going and to the Morning Star site and looking up Kate Middleton, Princess, doctored photographs, Photoshop. I couldn't find anything. So I presume the Morning Star has followed the policy, which I sort of like on one level. I always remember when Diana Spencer married Charles Windsor. The Morning Star, God bless its cotton socks, ran a story, about quarter of an inch story, saying traffic was disrupted in central London because of some wedding full stop. I sort of I think we all have something to say about royalty, by the way, but nonetheless, I appreciated the sort of how should I put it, disrespect that the Morning Star was showing. But of course, what we have with the Morning Star when it comes to changing photographs is, of course, a shameful history, which we in the communist movement know all about. And that would include famous photographs of the period after the October Revolution, with Lenin on a podium, you know, talking to people, must have been shouting, given it's not amplified. And next to him is his Commissar of War, Trotsky. And we know versions of that picture later, Lenin letting forth. And there's just a piece of plank of where Trotsky used to be. We know the pictures of Lenin sitting on a bench. We know that that's legitimate. Lenin sat on that bench. We think we do anyway. So I think we do. But then they plonk Stalin next to him. That wasn't photoshopping, but it's the same thing. And of course, we have the terrible history of Stalin's henchmen. I'll call them henchmen. Basically, you know, the heads of the KGB. I know it wasn't called that, changing its name, but the NKVD, whatever it happens to be, these people falling foul of Stalin and disappearing from photographs as they were executed. So you have Stalin walking, you know, along the Kremlin wall. And then his head of the secret police suddenly disappears. Look, I'm going to let you in to a secret. We all do it. Some of us do it honestly, some of us do it dishonestly. I don't know anything about Kate Middleton. I don't care anything about Kate Middleton. I presume that when you take a picture, you know, like a family snap, you pose, and everyone's meant to nowadays, I hate it myself, everyone's meant to smile. Every photograph, smile, cheese, all happy all the time. I'm not a naturally smiley person. I, you know, I sometimes go around, I should be photographed like that because that will get my character. And if you want to take a picture of me, you know, I'm not normally Mr. Smiley. Either way, my point is that families tend to want to project an idealized image of them. And if we take government ministers, I'm going to let you into a secret, they now each have an official photographer. And they're in a position where they can take the official photograph, and the other photographers are pushed aside, not let in. And of course, the photograph that the Mail, the Sun, the Mirror tends to go with is the official one, the officially approved version of it. And as I said, I'm going to let you into a secret. Here's the front page of this week's Weekly Worker. You should have seen it on the web. You might be lucky enough to have it had delivered already by the post office. Here's a photograph I would have, if I'd seen how dark it was, told our layout artists, make him lighter, make the placard light. You can do that, you just make it lighter. Produce a bit more light on the side here. But what we did do is that there in the picture, maybe you can see there's a sort of blurred image. Anyway, in the photograph, the original photograph, it was a clear image of a woman. And what we agreed to do is blur the background. So what we did is we actually cut the main figure, the Jewish comrade holding this placard. We cut him out, we blurred the picture and put him back in. Is that an honest picture? Be skeptical about everything you read, everything you hear, everything you see. That's the point. And we're not going to say that every image, because it's been passed by I don't know what agency, is therefore accurate. That's like saying every story in the press is accurate. We know that the stories in the press aren't accurate. We know they're full of lies. We know Michael Gove and the Tory government are trying to sell us lies every day, every week, every month. So we need to be skeptical, and we need to be skeptical about the left as well, because the left don't actually publish newspapers. What they publish in general is advertising sheets. I mean, would you believe an advert, from a capitalist company saying that, our washing up liquid is new, and it does it better? No, you wouldn't. And we shouldn't believe what the SWP or the Socialist or Workers' Power or the Communist or the Morning Star says automatically. We should approach it skeptically. We should try to get to the truth. And in our own way, that's what the Weekly Worker tries to do. And it's why we don't have an exclusive voice. We not only have a letters page full of sometimes nonsense, people who can't hear what speakers are saying, but hey, so what? We also have different voices in the paper, not only from non-CPGB members, but from CPGB members themselves. So it's up to the reader to work it out. We can't claim to be, the fountainhead of all truth, that everybody just says the truth. No, we don't. We try to, we strive to. And we do the best we can. And I can say that hand in heart. Do we fail sometimes? I'm sure we do. But we're open to criticism, including in the pages of the Weekly Worker. Okay, last 2 minutes. Meanwhile, in Gaza, the horror continues. Why hasn't Gaza dominated the headlines? And why have the headlines been dominated when it comes to Gaza by American airdrops and American deliveries of food aid by sea? Meanwhile, we have American-supplied aircraft dropping American-supplied bombs, shooting off American-supplied missiles and tanks, American-supplied tanks, closing in on Rafah, on a starving population. That's denied water, sanitation, medicine. That's actually what is going on. I don't know any other word to describe it other than a potential a genocide. That ought to be dominating the headlines of any honest news outlet. Not Kate Middleton, and I'm sorry, not even Diane Abbott. And this 10 million donation that ought to be covered. It is a story, it's a genuine story, but the real thing that ought to concern us clearly is what's going on in Gaza and in Palestine as a whole, i.e. The West Bank. That hardly gets a mention. And so my version of the truth is that Joe Biden is shedding crocodile tears, supplying meaningless amounts of so-called aid, meanwhile aiding and abetting a genocide that is happening right in front of our eyes. And the United States and its allies, not least the United Kingdom and its loyal opposition, is guilty of aiding and abetting genocide. That ought to be the story of the last 2, 3, 4 months.